The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution.
I usually see it translated as, and Leah was unloved. You know, Rachel's the loved one and Leah is unloved. But it's actually this word hate that just makes me so sad. Like,
Jacob is this gender nonconforming character, and Jacob is said to love Rachel and hate Leah, right? And then go on to love Joseph, who is this other kid who I think very much so is described as queer in the story.
The idea of Joseph as a queer character, or at least as a gender variant character, is like deeply encoded into the history of understanding this passage.
What in this story would prompt someone to pursue wealth and power, particularly over people who wanted to kill him and throw him in an empty cistern?
And to be clear, the problem is not the queerness. The problem is how other people respond to queerness, right? I just want to make that abundantly clear for anyone who might misinterpret that. The problem is not the difference. The problem is how people respond to the difference. So moving on a little bit further into the story, there's this strange little thing where Jacob basically sends off Joseph to go look for his brothers. And this is a pattern that we see repeated throughout the scriptures, that the youngest son is sent off by dad to go and look for the brothers to try and figure out what's happening, right? And then something dramatic happens to the youngest son. So here, Joseph is sent out to find his brothers, can't find them, goes to a different place, eventually finds them. David is sent off to find his brothers to bring them lunch at the battle, and then eventually is called to go and fight Goliath, right? And so this pattern is something that connects Joseph and David, right? Where David is seen as this salvific figure, in part because he mimics the story of Joseph in this way, right? And throughout the rest of this story, we see that Jesus is also connected back to Joseph in this story. And I don't think it is just sheer coincidence that his adopted father is Joseph, right? Because he is supposed to be also representing this Joseph figure throughout the story. Yeah.
Sorry, that's cool. That just got to me.
So thoughts about this story that results in Joseph being thrown in the well.
One thing with bridging from our dream talk to this next part where, yeah, Jacob has sent Joseph, what the brothers say as they see Joseph coming in, I think, verse 19, when they say, "Here comes the big dreamer." I really like the looking at the Hebrew there is Ba'al HaChalamot, which kind of like another way to translate that would be like master of the dream. Or there's a Jewish scholar's article I found, Karen Lee Ehrlichman translates it as keeper of the dream, that Joseph is the master or keeper of dreams. And that, again, like that, just it's interesting to me that that's sort of the title that Joseph's brothers have decided to use to like denigrate them or whatever. Like when it sounds freaking cool, like they chose a really cool sounding like insult. But again, for me, it just emphasizes the fact that what they feel threatened by is as insubstantial as dreams. Mm. Joseph doesn't have physical power over them. There's just one of Joseph, and there's so many more of the brothers. And yet they fear Joseph, to the point that, yeah, just all that Joseph's lord over is dreams, and yet they plot to kill Joseph. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's just something about that, again, when it, like, connecting that to, like, queerphobic violence in our own time and kind of throughout history of just, like, what's so scary about us? We don't have numbers on you. We don't have, like, massive strength. It's just dreams and creativity and ways of understanding ourselves, and yet you respond so violently to us.
Yeah,
I think that's what stands out to me too here is just the contemplative, like the takeaway from this is that his otherness, like his dreamer status, his prancing around in all this makeup with in these robes, and you know, like they have just over time, just simply because he's not like them, that they have stored up so much animosity and hatred that they eventually decide that he has to die. You know, I don't know if it's there to be cautionary or even whether the writer, like, it's not really being lifted out as a, you know, like they're not spotlighting this as a hate crime, is my point. They're just spotlighting it as like a crime of like jealousy, essentially. But I don't know, is there really a difference, right? Because think about, it is uncomfortable to be pressured to fit in a box for other people. Mm-hmm. And when you consent to that over and over again, I mean, I'm being glib, all right? I know what it's like to experience social pressure. I was in the closet at one point. I have gone along to get along and then like been mad at myself for it later. And when you see someone who's not going along with it, who's just being their damn powerful self anyway, it can make you feel really upset about the situation. If you are feeling so boxed in that you're starting to hate people who are like out of the box, I would think that that's an invitation not to like go down the hate rabbit hole, but like really sit with like, what is it inside that is so locked in that it's making you uncomfortable, and like, try to let it out instead of the hate, right? Because there's like a light in there.
And maybe try to like be like Jesus and love people instead of wasting your time hating people, because that just makes hell on earth, and none of us deserve to be in hell.
Right.
But they're not boring because they're inherently boring. They're boring because they suppress that part of them that is like you're saying, that is out of the box, be it queer, be it whatever. They've suppressed that creativity. They've suppressed their neurodivergentness, their whatever it is that doesn't fit out of the box. And they see someone else that is just unapologetically out of the box, and they're like, that motherfucker. because at the end of the day, it still comes down to jealousy, right?
Yeah. I'm going to nerd out for a second on Shechem and Dothan. Dothan probably is how it's pronounced. But so Shechem is the place where Joseph goes to find his brothers at first, and then they end up being in Dothan instead. And so Shechem, the significance of Shechem is that Shechem is where Abraham reached this great tree and offers a sacrifice to God. And in Genesis and Deuteronomy and Joshua and Judges, Shechem is hallowed as this really sacred place in the land of Israel, like supposed to be more important than all of the other places. And Shechem is connected to Jerusalem in that kind of way, that Jerusalem becomes the only place you can give sacrifice. And Deuteronomy is really important and really emphasizes that, right? And so Shechem is one of these holy places. So Joseph goes to this holy place to try and find them, and instead goes to Dothan. And Dothan is the city of two wells, right? And why is it the city of two wells? Well, presumably because they had one well that they got water from, and then one that was dry, the one that they threw him into. Dothan is not referenced very many other times in the Bible, but the one time that it is, it's because Elijah has all of these guys who are coming to kidnap him, and when they come to kidnap him in 2 Kings 6, God miraculously allows the servant who has come to threaten him to see what's actually there, and he is surrounded by these armies of chariots on fire, hidden angel chariot armies that would descend on his enemies if they come. And so you have this stark contrast between the first time we see Dothan as this place where Joseph is thrown into the well, left for dead, versus the second time where Elijah summons all this power to be able to protect him and stay in safety. Well, Dothan looks at first to be this place that is the source of Joseph's oppression, but is actually a secret way of him being saved. And so I really like that little contrast.
It's similar to the dreams themselves, because you mentioned how the there's this through line of the way that the dreams are visually. And in the first, they're the cause of his oppression. But in the second iteration, they're the cause of his liberation. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, is how we experience Dothan. We first, in our, the first time we experience them is in Joseph's oppression, and the second time we experience them is in liberation.
That's beautiful. That's like a resurrection story right there, right? Mm-hmm. Where you know, we look at the cross, and at first we see it as Jesus's death, but now because Jesus has returned, we see it as our source of liberation instead. You know, just like the word queer, right? At first it was the slur that was hurled against us, a source of death against us, and yet now we celebrate it, and I am very happy to be a queer person, right? Because I get to celebrate my out-of-the-boxness and the ways that God loves me and all of those things. Avery?
Oh, I just wanted to say I appreciate, like, I love that you brought that up, because that's a part of this story that I always skim past. And so it's just, it made me really happy. It was a great reminder that even though I've studied and read this story so many times, there's always something more to find. So thanks. I got excited.
Yeah. And I you know, when we're editing these podcasts, our editors do a wonderful job. I always give a listen through first and then offer any final notes. And then, and then I usually listen to it again. And the thing that the notes that I most often give our wonderful editorial team is, hey, could I just add like 45 more minutes of thoughts to this? Because I'm constantly, you know, I listen to the podcast and then I go, oh, and that's something that I didn't notice until now that I'm, you know, listening back and thinking about that I need to go and add in. So dear listeners, when we finish recording all the episodes about the Bible in approximately 10 years, we will start a rewatch podcast where we just listen to the podcast. And I'm just kidding, but as if anyone had the time for that.
I wanted to bring up, so the traders that come by, the Ishmaelites, they're carrying resin, right? Mm-hmm. Why is it medicinal?
So that's a great question. So this is really the thing that to me connects Jesus to Joseph, right? We see these three gifts: sweet resin, medicinal resin, and fragrant resin. And this is very similar to the gifts of the Magi that we see. We're recording this in December. It will probably be released in February. But, you know, we're thinking about the Christmas story: sweet resin, medicinal resin, and fragrant resin. What does that sound like? Incense, sweet resin, right? Frankincense, fragrant resin, and myrrh. I'm not absolutely confident on this connection, but the sweet resin, the medicinal resin, and the fragrant resin could certainly be associated with these gifts that the Magi bring of frankincense, incense, and myrrh, right? Where in the Jesus story, they're often just taken as these sort of symbols of what's happening in the rest of Jesus's life, right? Where it's going to be a thing where Jesus dies ultimately. These are symbols of Jesus's death, that he will come again. And here in this story, we can read this story in the order they're put in as the same sort of thing. With camels carrying a sweet resin, a childhood where he is doted on by a loving father, a medicinal resin where he is wounded because he is abandoned by his family, because he is left outside, and then a fragrant resin, right? Where not only is he redeemed from all those things and he becomes the liberation for everyone else, he brings this sweet smell to everyone else's life, right? That again reminds us of God demanding sacrifice and the scriptures describing the smell of fat rising up to God and pleasing God's nose, right? Is this fragrant smell. Liberation is the fragrant smell consistently throughout the Bible, where God even says, I do not want your sacrifices, but I want justice, right? And that is truly the sweet smell that we see. And so I just like here that these seemingly innocuous gifts are both seemingly replicated in the life of Jesus, but also sort of tell the story of Joseph's life in just these couple of words that we could just see as like this weird, unnecessary reference or color here in the story.
I'm going to use the phrase, justice is a sweet perfume, in one of my stories. I'm telling you now. that's an excellent closer.
So the other thing that I want to bring up here is, it's really interesting who comes in here to really protect Joseph, right? All of the other brothers want to kill him, but Reuben steps in and says no. And what's phenomenal about this is that Reuben is the firstborn. Like, he is the mm-hmm. firstborn of Leah, and Joseph is way down in the line. So by rights, like, Reuben should be the one who's getting this double portion. And instead of saying, yeah, I'm going to kill off my rival to the most wealth here, he's the one who steps in and tries to protect Joseph, right? He's the one who says, no, don't spill his blood, because he wanted to come back and save his little brother. And it seems like because Reuben convinces everyone to do that, that then Judah's mind is changed. And Judah says, hey, like, who does it benefit if we actually kill him? Like, let's at least make some money, right? And then
found the capitalist.
Yeah, exactly. The dirty capitalist. And then they sell him to Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. Not quite as much as Judas will get for Jesus, right? But it is literally the same name. Judah is the one who convinces yeah. them to sell out. And Judah is the one who sells out Jesus, right? So another connection here that really, I think this paragraph is so much so a reference here.
I absolutely agree with you that it is really cool that Reuben, as the eldest, is the one who steps in. I also think Reuben doesn't go far enough. Yeah. And this makes me think about like allyship or solidarity, where I don't like Reuben as the firstborn. I imagine he has a lot of sway among his brothers, and yet he doesn't flat out say, "We're not touching Joseph at all. What are you guys even talking about?" He says, "Oh, we can beat him and throw him in the cistern. Just don't kill him." That's not the same thing. That's like the phrase, "Give us our flowers while we're here." Don't come after we've been harmed and say, "Oh, how sad that people hurt you. Let me help." Stop us from getting hurt in the first place. Yeah. So like, absolutely kudos to Reuben, but also, dude, you could have done more. And I am glad that, like, once we get to the later episode, when we get a bit of a redemption arc for both Reuben and Judah, I don't want to, you know, spoil it. But
well, I'm also going to spoil part of his redemption and then his downfall as well. But, you know, actually, let's talk about Reuben, the motherfucker, later.
yeah, save it.
Oh, the other thing I wanted to reference here before we continue on is the Ishmaelites. Right. The Ishmaelites are like, they are their second or third cousins, right? These are people that they should know, right? And so this is interesting that the Ishmaelites are the people who come up here, that their families have been divided because of this greed, right? And here in this story, again, that symbol of their families having been divided by greed are the people who come to separate their family and cause them to be divided because of their greed and their selfishness. The last thing I want to talk about as this real connection here is that in verse 31 and 32, the brothers take Joseph's robe and they slaughter a male goat, right? And this male goat has all sorts of references throughout the scripture, but the most salient two are, first off, the innocent animal that has to be killed in the Garden of Eden because Adam and Eve realize that they're naked, right? Where this first action, this first sin, is responded to by violence against a totally innocent creature, right? Where Adam and Eve are the ones who mess up, and yet this innocent animal has to die to make up for the thing that they did wrong, right? This goes back to a very vegan ethic, a very holistic perspective, right? But this goat didn't do anything wrong, and yet he ends up being the victim of this violence. And it goes back to the scapegoat idea that happens in Leviticus, where they would basically cast lots, and one of these two male goats would take on the sins of all the people of Israel and then go out and be a substitute for their sins, right? And this male goat here is that sort of scapegoat. They've taken the sins of themselves and they've killed this goat so that they can cover up what they've done wrong, so that they don't take responsibility, so they don't have to deal with the problem that they've caused and the pain that they've caused their father. Instead, they just say, "We found this. See if it's your son's robe or not." And we know this robe is pretty distinctive. They got pretty pissed about it, right? It's not like they'd forget this robe all of a sudden. They are deliberately forgetting these things. They're deliberately putting on this front, pretending as if they don't even know who Joseph is because they've just killed him.
Also, just for me, the image of them holding up that robe is so haunting. this desecration. Like we've been talking about how that robe is a symbol of Joseph's queerness, and they desecrate it with, like you said, this violence against this goat, and also the violence against Joseph. Like, it just, the image, it's not a direct correlation, but them holding up this robe and all the sort of vitriol that they've poured into it, and just it reminds me of both sexual violence and anti-queer violence, especially violence against trans feminine people in our own day, where the comment is, look what they were wearing. Of course we had to do it to them. You know, this victim blaming of what did they expect when they went out dressed like that? Just, yeah, that's sort of the image that comes to mind for me when imagining them holding up this bloody robe.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I don't know, it conjures the image of the brutal murder of Matthew Shepard, and
yes,
how, yeah, like a lamb, he always seemed like a sort of Christ in the way he was innocently brought to his martyrdom.
Yeah.
And you see the people that perpetuate the language that caused that, holding up that murder in the same way that Joseph's brothers hold up the coat and say, mm-hmm, who's this? Does anybody recognize this?
And it strikes me as the Roman centurions casting lots for Jesus' clothes, right? Mm. And my favorite band in the world, Five Iron Frenzy, they have this wonderful line that politicians are casting lots for Jesus' clothes, right? That they're out here playing the game with our lives. And that brings me back to what Avery said before, that don't be happy for us or miss us when we're gone. Love us now, right? Mm-hmm. Love the Palestinians now when we have a chance to do something about it, right? And Mike was talking earlier about being a Christian pacifist, and I am a Christian pacifist most of the time. And then I think mm-hmm. about what's happening to the Palestinians, and I think, how am I supposed to solve this situation? And then I see courageous anarchists like those going on in the Bay Area who are stopping trains because they know that those trains bring the weapons and the tools of destruction that will cause the death of Palestinians. And they've stopped it in a way that doesn't harm the train driver who isn't signed up for this, right? Who isn't trying to participate in this. He's just desperately trying to make a living because his wages have been cut because Joe Biden won't allow him to unionize. You know, we aren't seeking to cause more harm. We're seeking to stop a system that is causing the harm against us, right? And the final connection here that has to be made is that scapegoat, right? That slaughtered male goat is again Jesus, right? I don't believe in a theology that says that Jesus's blood is what saves us. Like that blood has some sort of magical power that if you touch it, you know, all your sins can go away or something. I don't believe that blood has some magical property. I don't think that Jesus's blood is what washes us free, right? I think that Jesus was a sinless person who came to the world, who was God, and got killed because he showed the world what love looked like, and the world couldn't handle it.
It was the threat of nothing but a dream. Like, it's the same issue with Absolutely. Joseph of Jesus came with this dream.
Yeah.
And empire couldn't handle it.
And because of that, we killed him, right?
Yeah.
We slaughtered this innocent person, made him into a scapegoat. And what's liberatory about that is that he came back to life, right? Is that he won over the system of sin and death that seeks to oppress us and thus liberated all of us from it. But that doesn't mean that we don't keep slaughtering these scapegoats, right? That there aren't innocent people throughout our history who are made into these same sort of slaughtered scapegoats, and we continue to raise up their robe to the people that have lost them and say, what happened here? Who do you recognize this? And I think it's our calling as leftists, as Christians, to be in solidarity with those people. But also sometimes we are called to be those people who are slaughtered because we have dared to dream and dared to love more than the world has room under its systems of power.
Well, you opened up a whole bunch of deep thoughts in me with this whole idea of the male goat and it's interesting, like this idea of absolving guilt through the murder of something innocent. And like we even touched on Amos, it's like, I don't want the stench of your sacrifice. It's like, no, I want justice, right? Because this idea that like Jesus had to die and now, you know, because it's the way the evangelical church uses this is like a free pass. Like you just show up in a church and say the sinner's prayer, like poof, you're struck magically like sinless. And like, I don't know what, as I have worked out my own like sense of salvation or whatever you want to call it, I look at that and I go, oh my God, like an innocent man died. And that doesn't make me go, yay, I'm saved. It makes me go, wow, what is the cumulative effect of even the little things that I do? And how does collective harm add up to terrible atrocities? And what can I do to like unpack myself so that I'm not a part of those systems anymore? And hopefully together we can break those cycles in the end. Like that's what quote salvation means to me. Like, I don't think he's there to like magically strike us sinless with his blood. Like, I think it's a cautionary tale. Look what happens when you're not careful. I thought you were going to mention like the Isaac goat. Like there's this moment where like, Abraham's going to kill him. And God's like, holy shit, what are you doing? Kill this goat instead. Like, I don't know where you got the wires crossed, but like, here, kill this goat. Right. I don't know. I'm rambling and I'm sure you all covered that on another episode. So I'll stop now.
No. Yeah. No, absolutely. Continue on that point because I didn't make that connection explicitly because I didn't think it reinforced my point. And I want you to explore it because I want to hear differing opinions.
Some people are like, you know, this is Abraham being obedient and, you know, but then there's the take where like, why would God tell you to murder your own kid? Like, that doesn't make sense. Like we don't do human sacrifice. If you think about it, God doesn't really talk to Abraham after that. Like, it's kind of like, you can read the story as like, God is actually like shocked. And like, it's more like a cautionary tale where it's like, sometimes you can think God is talking to you when God isn't. And, you know, but I don't know. It kind of breaks down because it is an important piece of the story. So it's almost like both interpretations can like, if you believe in the human sacrifice thing, like, okay, but that take doesn't resonate with me, but it's an interesting story. And I'm not sure I'm making a point either because now I'm tired too.
Well, first off, I want to say that your interpretation is very much so the interpretation that Scott McCandless takes in Retelling the Bible podcast. I highly recommend everyone go and listen to that version because it is like Abraham becomes convinced of this thing. God does not show up in the story. And then Abraham, like in a moment of lucidity, sees a goat and says, oh, okay, maybe God meant that instead of my son, right? But I also think that, you know, we go back to what our friend of the pod, Derek White, often says is it's a Girardian instinct, right? And Girard is this philosopher who basically thinks that humans have this sort of blood wish that like we want to see violence done against our rivals, but that we can take that and instead put it on a scapegoat, and that God is constantly saying, okay, I see where you're coming from. I'll allow it. Like we can transfer that onto this. And so Abraham becomes convinced he has to sacrifice his son. And God says, as a concession to Abraham's humanity and this rivalry and this hatred that causes all of these problems, the separations of family and all of this oppression, God says, okay, I see that you're here with your son on the mountain. I'm going to provide this goat instead because I don't want you to kill your son. I don't want you to lose this one thing that we've been working on for so long. And I don't want you to feel like I don't love you anymore because you felt called to this thing that you weren't actually called to and yet carried out this atrocious act. And so I love complicating that story. And I love your opinion there, Mike, because I did leave it out of this reference because I thought it was going to be more complicated than just referencing Jesus. But it comes back to Jesus, right? That we don't have to say, yeah, God sent Jesus to die, right? We can say that, no, again, it was a concession to humanity that Jesus had to die because that is what humans do when we see a love so pure that it breaks all of the boundaries that we had previously set up.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we don't, like, we're not faced with a binary choice between, like, this is barbaric ancient goat herders and, like, I wash my hands of this story. Or like, I have to sign up for these weird like sacrifice narratives. Like, I can also just say, you know what? This moves me to like be more civilized than humanity has been in the past. This moves me to do better. And I think that's like really helpful to remember.
Especially in a society that continues to sacrifice people. You know, we just, at the moment, we're sacrificing the Palestinians, you know, for the quote unquote right of the state of Israel to exist. When in fact, we could find a solution that is just, you know, A, not having a state, or B, if you insist on having a state, maybe not an apartheid state, but
yes.
Even saying that we're sacrificing Palestinians so that Israel might exist, like, really, there's the real layer is we're sacrificing Palestinians because we want power in the region that's labeled the Middle East. Like, that's the real truth. It's even pretending that it's to support Israel is a little bit of a facade. Like,
it's the oil and opiates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it all, what a shock. It, just like in Genesis, it all comes down to wealth and money and capitalism.
And the way that that divides us, right?
Yeah.
I think the thing that comes away for me is the fact that this is, once again, the story of people who are left on the outside, people who are lower down, being raised up, right? This is, again, just an illustration of God's continual preferential option for the poor, because the people who are down below in these inheritance story are stand-ins for the poor, because this book is written in the middle of the Babylonian exile when all of the Jewish people are desperately clinging on for hope. This is a story told by an oppressed people to an oppressed people about how they will have the hope to survive this. And here Joseph is put into the depths of despair. He is left here. He is scapegoated out. He is the victim of all of this violence. And yet he will be the means of salvation for not just his family, but for the entire world. And I think that we as leftists, as we face the myriad persecutions that we will face throughout our lifetime, when we face all of the problems that will face us as activists, as people who care about our neighbors, as people who love others outside of the box that our world is comfortable with us loving, that we have to stand in the knowledge that we are also on the path to bringing about liberation for the whole world, even the people who hate us for doing so. Well, Josiah, Mike, and Avery, thank you all just so much for this wonderful podcast. I think it'll easily be two episodes. So thank you all so much for being a part of this. And thank you, dear listener, for continuing to be here. If this is the first podcast that you've listened to because you've come from one of these wonderful people, please go back and listen to our other episodes. I think you'll also find them wonderful. But this has been one of my favorites to record. And so I hope that y'all get as much out of it as I have. So thank you all so much for being here. Thank you all for how you support the show, how you share it, how you bring it to all of the other people, and how you've made this small little idea that Ephemeral and I were just throwing around a little while ago into something that is real and lasting and meaningful for just so many people. Thank you. Now, Past Micah, take it away.
Thank you, Future Micah. And of course, you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. And now go and dream a dream bigger than anyone else has dreamed before, so that we might be a part of making it come true. Shalom.
I remember the Sunday school teacher drawing, like, we were going through like everybody else's gods, and he was like drawing their picture and then telling us why they're like Satan. And like, I remember being, you know, like 11 years old or however old I was that day, and just thinking, you know, that's not very loving. you know, very childlike, mm-hmm. and like that didn't match up. So yeah, that was kind of that sticks out in my memory.